Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, Movie Geeks United on a Sunday night. Jerry, hey.
Hey, what's going on? Well, every Sunday is like Movie Geeks United night, so what's going on, man? How you doing?
Just fantastic. I'd like to start the show by saying, happy birthday, Al Pacino!
Happy birthday, Al Pacino, that's right. Oh my God.
He turned 70 years old today.
Wow.
This has been the E.T. birthday whatever. Call 1-800-FLOWERS, or is it? I don't know. Gosh, I wish you're
on your own there, man. But happy birthday, Mr. Pacino. And, you know, watching him last night, you know, and you don't know Jack, and, you know, thinking about it and thinking about the films we were talking about, actually when we did that tribute show to him 3 years ago, you know, he's a presence. He's still a presence after all these years. He's still got it. No, I mean, it's not just that movie, but even if he, you remember that was a period in the 80s where he did nothing, you know, he stopped. He went in between Revolution and Sea of Love. He was working on the local Stigmatic, that was it. And, you know, and it was probably wise because Revolution, regardless of what certain individuals say about it, is not him at his best.
Right.
It was a huge disappointment, but at that time, movies about the American Revolution did not do very well. I think actually The Patriot was like the first time that a big budgeted movie about that topic had done very well at the box office. And that was disappointing. It was a Hugh Hudson film. He did Chariots of Fire and Greystoke, and that was a disappointment. But when Al's on, and when I mean on, I'm not talking about the usual, like people like to say the yelling or the screaming, but when he's on, when he's fully engaged in the character, like I do think the Barry Levinson film, You Don't Know Jack, is definitely, there's something very haunting about his performance, especially after watching Jack Kevorkian the night before and Bill Maher.
Right.
It's a fascinating movie. The performances are good, not just Pacino, but I think Goodman, I think Sarandon, Brenda Vaccaro, I think everyone is very good. James Urbanek is good, from who's in Henry Fool and is a Hal Hartley regular. It's a fascinating film. Let me ask you this though. What do you think of Kevorkian?
I think of Kevorkian that he provides a compassionate service, and but he himself does not give off a vibe that reeks of warmth or compassion. I think
it doesn't. But let me ask you this: when this is going on,
and ghoulish. I mean, there's a ghoulish aspect to him too.
There's a ghoulish aspect, sure. Now, we got into this last night because my dad was a physician for 40 years, and we had learned, actually, because he said, no, none of my patients, he was an oncologist, and, you know, you think about it, cancer, most of the time, a terminal disease. It was revealed by my mother, of all people. I will not name names here, but these friends that I thought were just friends of ours were actually one of my dad's patients, and it had turned out that they had asked him to, you know, he wanted to die.
Right.
Because it was an uncurable form of cancer they had. Now, of course, my dad, of course, claims that they had no knowledge of this, but my mom brought this up. And when I realized who the people were, it was quite a revelation. Because I had no idea that, I thought these were just friends. I had no idea that these were patients who had become friends. And it was quite an astounding revelation. You know, when he was practicing medicine, was against what Kevorkian was doing, still is. I look at it like this, and especially when one of the characters who is the ALS, the Lou Gehrig's disease, I mean, if you are that, I don't understand why why it is wrong. If you want to die, if you're in that much pain and agony, I don't see the thing of why you want to be put out of your misery. I don't see why that's wrong. I honestly don't see, I don't understand what is this, and it's when this religion gets involved in it. Oh, it makes me angry.
Well, there's a little bit of that in the movie, but actually the movie is pretty, I mean, I don't know. Where do you think the movie falls in terms of taking sides? It's about Jack Kevorkian.
It's about him. I don't think it takes, I think towards the, you could almost say it is even-handed, and especially in the courtroom scene at the end, when the judge reads the verdict and gives her her spiel there, you know, I do think it is even-handed. I don't think it paints him out to, you know, as a martyr.
Mm-hmm.
Although at times it does come close to that, I think. And that's because of Pacino's performance. And there's something very, in his performance, he has this, it's amazing that how much makeup he was wearing in Godfather 3. You realize that. You realize, wow. Because, no, his posture and everything, doesn't it remind you of Michael in the right before he has the diabetic stroke?
I mean, he's just sitting in the chair in that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you actually see his mopey posture as he's walking and
yeah,
standing.
I mean, yeah, but you see it in some of Godfather 3, but here it's just, I mean, it's really amazing how he really inhabits Kevorkian. It's no longer Pacino. It's really, you don't even recognize
yeah.
him halfway through the film. It's Jack Kevorkian.
It is that kind of performance. It's pretty astounding. The movie, I think, is really good. I think he has the Emmy,
the Golden Globe, everything locked up.
Yeah, yeah. I do think Pacino is the movie, and he's surrounded by good actors that raise up to his level. But
yeah.
his is really the only character that's fleshed out.
Mm-hmm.
It's about him, really. So I mean, I was very impressed with the performance.
Yeah,
that's where I fall in line. It's always good to start a show with a conversation on assisted suicide.
Well, I mean, it's. But let me ask you this. I just don't, you know, this is where I fall. If you are in pain and agony, if you really cannot function the way you want, I do not see if this is a service that he offered, and I mean, God, he might still do it, who knows. But if I don't have a problem with it. I mean, if I had Lou Gehrig's or if I couldn't function, you know, I would want it too.
The movie shows too the people that he turns down because
mm-hmm.
they're clinically depressed and they can't, they do have an opportunity to live a fuller
yeah,
life.
Yeah, I mean, it is, and that's very important. And I mean, it actually is a huge distinction to bring up, to point out. It is the people who just cannot function.
Yeah.
The way
I think it's one of those controversial topics. I mean, and it's not so much about the topic as it is about the complications of the man,
mm-hmm.
Which is really what drives the movie. And I think it's one of those topics and subjects that is prime for HBO.
I think it's good. I think it was great. But here's a guy, a pathologist. You know, he didn't really have contact with anyone living. So
yes.
I found that fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
It is just a lot of, and you know who I did like in the movie, and I don't always like him, but when he's good, when he earns his last name, is Danny Houston, and I thought he was incredible.
He's very good,
I mean, but he's not, you know, always sometimes in The Proposition, he's like A+, 100%, and here I felt the same way. He was just like on top of things, on top of his game, big time.
Yeah, yeah. We have a caller.
Yeah, all right. Now, before we do this, before we take this call, do we want to take guess who it is? Do we know?
I think this is Teresa, 231 area code. Hi, Teresa. How are you?
Hi. I'm fabulous. I just finished a replay of the interview I did with Michael Schmeichel. Don Schmeichel. And
uh-huh.
I will see who's on, and you were having a same very good conversation, so I wanted to chirp in.
Please,
okay, well,
by all
chirp
means.
In, please.
Oh, yes. I am a screenwriter. And
mm-hmm.
one of the questions that I asked Don was, when you choose a product, what criteria do you use? How do you choose the product?
Mm-hmm. And what was his response?
Yeah, well, I'm curious.
Well, he basically said it depended a lot on genre and how he was approached.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, basically that the tagline was the first thing that got his attention.
That when he's writing a screenplay, he has to picture the tagline before he writes it? Is that what he's saying?
No, when he chooses a project, he produces.
Oh, okay,
did,
I got you.
He did
okay,
the special effects for the, I don't know if he did it for the second two Lord of the Rings movies.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Well, I can see how that applies to a producer. In
yeah.
terms of a, in terms of screenwriter, I mean, mm-hmm. the we've asked questions of people before, should you write what's popular in the marketplace or should you write from your heart?
Right.
And the answer has been, you know, everybody's trying to write what's popular in the marketplace, and you're competing against, you know, thousands
yeah.
upon thousands of people, and you're going to be ho-hum, write from what's
yeah.
in
yeah.
your
I mean,
in
I,
your
I,
heart.
I write from my heart.
Yeah, I think you got to write from your heart, which not so much what you know, but what you the story that you want to tell. Because if you're going to
mm-hmm.
do the marketplace, but let's say you're lucky someone buys that, someone options
mm-hmm.
it or whatever. By the time that comes out, the chances of that still being hot are nil to
yeah.
none.
Right.
The way, and especially in the way the environment is today, it's so rapid fire trends,
mm-hmm.
you know, come and go by the end of the day almost.
Yeah. No, I do things ass backwards. I found that I've written a military series, and it's basically going to be picked up for a new on-demand network. I just can't find an executive producer. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where I'm not normal, and I'm proud of it.
No, but I mean, you could be in this industry. You can't be. I don't see how you can be, because if you do start copying people, I think you're gonna burn yourself. You're
mm-hmm.
gonna just like really, you know, and you're gonna stop yourself dead in your tracks. You really have to go with the story that you want to tell, because
right.
once you start telling the story that other people. First of all, it won't sound authentic,
right.
and you're going to lose at the end of the day.
Right. Now, when you choose the project to work on, what makes you choose a project?
Are you thinking that Kevin Pollak's on the line right now?
Yes.
He's not.
Oh, okay.
yeah.
These are the hosts of the show.
Oh, okay.
That you've been talking to. I'm so sorry.
Kevin
Pollak is our guest.
Okay.
And I think we kind of asked him that. I mean,
yeah,
his criteria.
Well, maybe we should play the interview.
we'll play the interview now, Teresa. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. No, I'm also interested in, since you have somewhat, everybody has a point of view.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So when you go to a movie or when you watch a TV series, what makes you stick with it? As a writer, I'm asking.
I have to relate to it on some level to really stick with it, to really identify
mm-hmm.
with it. There has to be, I'm not just talking about like a cathartic thing maybe, but I have to at least have some empathy with the characters. There's something,
mm-hmm.
And this is very true of 90s independent, early 90s independent film or late 80s with Jim Jarmusch, Hal Hartley, David O. Russell, those kind
mm-hmm.
of filmmakers. I found something to identify very strongly with those characters. Also, Allison Anders, for that matter. In this,
right.
the last decade, it would be David Gordon Green and Noah Baumbach. I found a very deep identification. And also, it helps that I, you know, the same age as those directors,
right.
that I really, I think their films, their stories struck a powerful chord with me, and in turn, that influenced my own writing. When I do sit down to actually write, which sadly is not as much as I would like or as motivated as I would like,
yeah.
but those things, I found in those characters, male and female, there were things that, wow, you know, we see it, you know, if you go back into older films, you do see it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just something with Generation X, my generation, that when these people started to write books and to make films and to make music, there was a huge, deep identification going on.
Mm-hmm.
I could say, oh, my God, this really, I know what this is like. I understand this. And that's always, for the last 20 years at least, it's really been my point of liking something for the most part.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been finding really frustrating is the fact that they're doing so many remakes.
Yeah.
And they're not making the only thing that's better is the special effects. But when it comes to character and plot, they did it perfect the first time, and all they're doing is, you know, spiffing it up with some special effects.
No, that's...
And
it's a sad state of affairs.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is, Aunt Teresa, is this goes back a long way, but it does seem now there's... it's all monetary because it's about selling a DVD box set. Usually, it's like
yeah.
if you want to make a TV, like if you want, like I'm making them, like the A-Team. Obviously, the A-Team movie. I know we're going to be about to be bombarded probably with the A-Team on Blu-ray and DVD box sets galore,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to help sell those. It's all about
right.
selling the library at this point when you do these remakes,
yeah.
like the Nightmare on Elm Street remake that opens this week. I'm sure there must be special Blu-ray editions and DVDs that have come out in the last couple of weeks. To capitalize on that. And sadly, that's what it's about at this point.
Yeah.
Well, it's all about what sells. And remakes are great because for the industry, because they do sell and because they have name recognition.
Mm-hmm. That's the brand.
I mean, they're pre-sold in a way because people, it's already part of the language, the title and the property. So that takes care of a big chunk of the marketing.
But the thing
for
that is, the industry is basically imploding because they're not getting the big bucks like they used to. If you match dollar for dollar, movies that you know that what they're making today to 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
they're not pulling in the money.
No, they're not. I mean, I think the perfect example that I realize what you're saying is the ticket prices. They had to raise.
Mm-hmm.
It's not attendance. Attendance, I don't think, is up, even though they'd like to tell you that. Look at the 3D. Look at the difference in the when you go to buy a 3D ticket as opposed to
mm-hmm.
a regular ticket. Anything you release in 3D is going to outgross anything else just because it's like $4 or $5 more than a regular price ticket.
Right.
So, you know, and that's a, you know, while I'm not crazy about that, whoever came up with that idea, it was a brilliant piece of marketing, a brilliant strategy, but it's you see why something like Clash of the Titans or... And I do like How to Train Your Dragon, but you see why that's doing better than these other films that have come out. It's just that it makes more money.
You know, I don't think the industry is hurting. I don't think it's hurting at all. I think they're making a lot of money. I think attendance, if it's not up, it's constant.
The problem is
that people are flocking to see the lowest common denominator movies. We don't live in a time anymore where people want to be challenged by cinema, and I don't see a change in that. I don't see any way that tide could turn because the society isn't as socially conscious as it once was. We don't want to be challenged.
Society was socially conscious. I think those are the films. A lot of the films that we like, Jamie, that we like. I know what time period you're talking about. While they are critically lauded and they're very good, they were not commercially big successful films. Some of those films that we worship and adore did not do well. It was the Airport 77s or Airport 75s usually outgrossed those films.
Well, you can still make
but they were commonplace.
Movie.
They were commonplace, but it's not this thing. I don't know if there was ever this. You are really giving the American public a lot of credit.
So you don't think we've become stupider over the past 30 years?
Oh, I'm not sure whatever. Jamie, let me say, I'm going to say this right now. I don't know if we are ever bright. Let's put it like that. Okay, there was always people like Pauline Kael or other critics championing those films. If those films weren't championed, I don't even know if we would know about them.
I think you own, okay.
There are a lot of great films, tons of great films in the 30s. A lot of those great films that we love, they were duds, box office poison.
Mm-hmm.
And when a country was listening to the radio to every word that Father Coughlin was saying, I have a hard time believing that they were the ones like going to see the great films of that time. We've always been this country on the verge of mediocrity and stupidity. It's not something that changed overnight. It wasn't something like everyone drank the Kool-Aid. Everyone was drinking the Kool-Aid for the most part, And if something got through, it was because of a writer or a critic or someone championed that. I don't think it was it. We look, H.L. Mencken said so long ago, no one ever went broke underestimating the stupidity of the American public. And that hasn't changed. I don't think I used to believe what you believe, Jamie, but just looking at history and everything, it's amazing we got this far.
Well, history says in the Vietnam War, people were invested. It was being brought into our living rooms. People were invested in it. There was a very vocal demonstration against it.
There was a youth brought that.
But I've got a question to pose. Is it that the people are going to movies that they enjoy, or that they are just accepting what's being put out there?
They're going to the movies that they're being sold.
Jamie's right. I mean, and that hasn't changed though. That really hasn't.
And but you know, if there was something good, when something good comes out, people go to it.
When something good, for the most part, I think there are things like that.
If they're able to.
If they're able to, but sadly, a lot of, if I sound like a snob, I'm sorry, but something great like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or The Ghost Rider, they're not in wide release.
So,
but I don't think, even if you put these films in wide releases, There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men, while they did well, people weren't flocking to them.
Yeah.
They were great. They're masterpieces as far as I'm concerned. Atonement is a masterpiece. All the movies that were nominated that year, I thought, were extremely good films. They were, with the exception, I think, of Juno, they were not what we would call blockbusters. They made more money than they would have maybe in other years, but still, there is a disconnect. Sean Levy brought this up, you know, always brings this up on his blog, Mad About Movies. There is a disconnect between critics and the American movie-going audience. And not even the American movie-going audience. It's the worldwide audience.
Right.
It really is. If you look at it, I know they don't love our comedies, and they don't love our superhero movies, but outside of that, they love everything we export.
Right.
You know, they really, all right, they do love, they love The Dark Knight, and they should. That's actually a very well-made film. But like Batman Begins, if you look at the difference in grosses between that, it's astounding. Batman Begins did all right, but The Dark Knight was just a title, a tsunami, for a variety of reasons, and I think the main one being the late Heath Ledger. But it just, I know we're wax nostalgic about this, and there were incredible, awesome films. The audiences weren't always flocking to them, though.
Yeah. I don't know. I worked in movie theaters for years when I put myself through college, and it was at the time of Star Wars, and, you know, the originals were better than the first three.
Oh, of course.
Because you got to know more about the characters. And the second, the prequel was more about I can do this with special effects. And I think that's one of the reasons I don't go to films that much anymore.
Right. Well, the thing is that it's all, as a screenwriter, the first three films are all backstory that could have been written, summarized in two pages or less, probably. You didn't need to know that. I don't need to know to see T. Lawrence getting thrown out of boarding schools. I don't need to see Rick running guns in Ethiopia. I know when I see these characters, their backstories are either said in a couple lines of dialogue, and that's all I need to know. I don't need to know that to – it's almost like we rob ourselves of the directors, especially Lucas is very guilty of this, and I think Ridley Scott's going to become guilty of this with his Alien prequel. They rob us of our imaginations. They don't. I like to hexy my own interpretation of events, of how I'd like to have my own view on it. I don't think I need everything spelled out for me.
Well, like The Highlander, the first movie was fabulous.
And they ruined it.
And the TV series was fabulous. The last movie sucked rocks.
That second movie where they explained everything, I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't. I really don't understand Ridley Scott's argument for making an Alien prequel.
Oh, dude, it's mind-boggling. I'm just like,
because his argument is, because he says, I'm doing it essentially because they've killed the franchise. So let's make another one. You know?
Let's kill it even further.
Yeah.
And what the prequel is going to explain is I don't know the names of the different lore for the Alien series, but you know when they go to the planet and you see what looks like a gigantic astronaut frozen in his whatever creature it is before the thing comes out of the egg and
mm-hmm.
lands on
yeah.
John Hurt's face. That's what they're explaining. So it's 30 years prior to Ripley even being born.
I know. I don't understand. I never, you know, when I was, every time I watched the originals, that really never stood out. You know,
yeah.
Oh, I want to know his story.
I got to know what that is.
You know, it's like at the end when you exited Tomb Raider. I wasn't, there's no one who said, do you want to see a sequel to this movie? No. I don't know. You know, it's like, no, it's the Alien prequel is something of grave concern because after watching the first Alien versus Predator, I turned to my brother and I was like, wow, they effectively killed two series with one movie. And the second one, it was more of the same. But I just don't see – I don't need to know how that started. It's like going to the bottom of the well.
See, the second one I think is a great sequel because it's a lot better than
the first.
It's still about Ripley.
Yes, I was talking about the Alien versus Predator series.
Oh, no. I'm talking about the camera.
No.
And yet it brings something new to the table.
It
embeds her in the action genre, in a way. It's
an incredible sequel, an incredible film on its own merits. I was talking about the silly ones they made based on the comic book, the Alien versus Predator, like we really needed
right.
a movie version of those.
Right, right.
Well, you know, a lot of the remakes... It's like the people who wrote the movies, like a lot of the TV series, when they went to movies, the Beverly Hillbillies was the best example of the writers that did the movie had no idea what the TV series was about.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And, you know, they turned these wonderful, unique, classic characters into morons.
Well, I've talked about this too on the show. It's actually one of the top 10 trends of the past decade on that show, which was about how TV shows have gone to the movies now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a level of, it goes back to what we were talking about with remakes and that kind of thing. There's the name recognition that's
mm-hmm.
already there.
Yeah.
But plus it's the mentality too that they're tapping into. People that just would rather sit at home and watch TV, and now they can do it by going to the movies.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
No, the Beverly Hillbillies, the TV series, it was culture shock, and
mm-hmm.
that's what made it funny because you had these wise people in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even Jethro had a unique specialness of wisdom about him.
Right.
And in the movie, he was just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got into movies that honor stupid. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, there's the great movie the most intelligent movie about stupidity is The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, you're right.
That's a classic. But
that is.
Yeah.
This thing. It's really interesting. It's amazing, you know, that the things they do want to make into movies and TV. Like remember, there was a Car 54, Where Are You movie that came out.
Mm-hmm.
It came in a McHale's Navy and a Sergeant Bilko.
Mm-hmm.
And they all missed the thing, what made those shows so great. First of all, Sergeant Bilko, as much as I like Steve Martin, he's no Phil Silvers. So you couldn't recapture that. McHale's
yeah.
Navy, you couldn't recapture Ernest Borgnine and the whole group of actors. It was a series. It was also a lot of chemistry between
yeah.
that entourage, if you will. And they really is, first of all, you're making these movies in the early 90s, and these are things, I believe, in the 50s and the early 60s. You
yeah.
can't recapture that. It's a different time period.
Yeah.
They're lost. There's a lot lost in translation.
CBS is going to be redoing Hawaii Five-0. Has nobody told them that Jack Lord is dead?
You can't do it without Jack Lord. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You can't. Look,
Jack Lord is dead.
And
Jack Lord was Steve McGarrett, and Steve McGarrett was a show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really,
I'm surprised they haven't made that into a movie, though.
I'll give it time, they will.
By now.
Yeah.
But they're rebooting it as a TV series before it's tried to
yeah.
become a movie.
Well,
I mean, it's
the
an exotic locale. And,
yeah.
you know,
Star Trek.
Hair that doesn't move.
Yeah. Star Trek worked in the movies because you had the original cast and they updated it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the new generation worked because it didn't try to be the original. They took the concept and did it different.
Right.
And there are so many wonderful ideas out there that, you know, TV these days sucks because it's, you know, the cheap reality shows that
right.
are boring.
Mm-hmm.
And TNA, which is boring.
Mm-hmm. But what's boring? What's the last thing that's boring?
TNA.
Oh.
I mean...
Well, I have to disagree with you there, but...
Well, I don't see it. I don't see that on TV, but I understand what you're saying, though. But what about some, like, just, like, the, on, like you have FX, Sci-Fi, HBO,
mm-hmm.
Showtime.
I think it reflects movies, because there's a lot of crap. But actually, on
yeah.
TV, there's a lot of good dramatic series,
mm-hmm.
too, now. That
yeah.
I think maybe 10 years ago, we didn't get quite as many daring shows as we have now.
I think HBO is really responsible for really upping the
yes.
TV game with Oz and The Sopranos and... Even before
yes.
that, even with Dream On, which was one of their first original, and they really slowly built this up. But you see it on Showtime, has a lot of great shows. FX, Sci-Fi is
right.
moving. They're all USA.
USA was doing pretty good, and then they started coming out with White Collar, which
right.
I'm sure Eddie Albert is rolling over in his grave because it's a remake of Switched.
Mm-hmm.
Psyched is good, but a lot of the, you know, the newer ones are, you know, TNA is good for a couple of episodes, but after a certain point it gets boring.
Oh, what are you talking about TNA? Is that the wrestling thing?
No,
TNA. Oh, okay. That's what I thought, yeah.
Jiggle TV. Adrian Paul, who I consider one of the most gorgeous men on this planet, he did a short-lived series called Tracker.
I do remember that. I do.
And it was, I watched it for the first 6 episodes because you got to practically see him naked in every episode, but even that got boring. I mean,
I know I'd be bored by it, but.
Well, yeah.
Teresa.
I'm
sorry. I'm sorry. I was just going to say we appreciate you calling in very much.
Yeah.
What's your show? You have a show here on BTR?
Yes, until you walk the path, you don't know where it goes. And
all right, cool. We'll definitely listen.
And what's the URL for that?
I think it's Teresa Chase.
Okay.
I sent, if you're Movie Geek Unlimited, we're each other's friends. And I do have a favor to ask both of you. If you will email me, I will send you the pilot episode of my TV show. That
right,
oh, we'd
yeah.
love it.
Yeah, definitely.
We'd love it.
And, well, actually, I'll put it in the chat room, and I would love your feedback on it.
Okay, no, great. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Teresa, and feel free to call back anytime in the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I monopolized your show.
No,
that's great.
No, you've been a blessing. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I've got a few connections, if you're looking for guests.
Okay.
So,
no, okay.
Thank you.
Anyway.
Thank you.
I got to go, so I will talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, Teresa. Anyway, happy birthday, Al Pacino.
Happy birthday, Al Pacino. Thank you, Teresa, for calling in. That was a very good conversation.
Hey, Sherlock Holmes 2 is probably going to be in 3D now. Yeah.
You know, what is it? The Last Airbender is going to be in 3D?
Yes.
The Hornet
yeah.
is going to be in 3D? I mean... You know, what else is going to be in 3D? I hope the Expendables will be in 3D at this rate.
Yes, three-dimensional bad acting. It's almost like a contradiction in terms.
That movie, each time I see the trailer, dude, I just wish it was August already, man.
Two-dimensional characters in 3D. Cannes Film Festival, they've announced a lineup, haven't they?
I think they have, it should be, the Robin Hood is going to be there. And is Tree of Life going to be there?
No.
Oh, shit.
Malik, it's not ready.
One car away with 2046 now. It's not okay.
They say it's pretty much done.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there. There's just some elements that aren't there. Apparently, the Doug Liman movie, the Fair Game, about the Valerie Plame, with Sean Penn and Naomi Watts, it'll be there.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Apparently, American films aren't very well represented at this year's Cannes.
They are. Or they aren't.
They are not.
Okay, well, I mean, maybe...
Not in competition, anyway.
Yeah, competition or not. But Woody Allen's going to be there, though, right?
Yeah, Woody Allen's new movie, When You Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger. That'll be there.
Okay.
Robin Hood. That's marketing the way Robin Hood's premiering there. But
yeah, I don't. You know, it's going to be there. What, it opens May 14th. There's really no reason. I mean, I'm curious to see it, even though it has that weird Normandy like sequence in it, with the boats and everything. But I'm curious about it. Even though
I feel the same way about Robin Hood that I felt about Sherlock Holmes. I'm just not interested. I mean, another.
But what about Sherlock Holmes and Robin Hood in the same movie? Now that would be fascinating. You know what movie I'm really looking forward to, Jamie? You know what movie I really, more so than Iron Man 2 or anything else, I really just want to see MacGruber at this point.
Yeah.
I just want to see MacGruber.
That's after that whole big argument about the stupidity of...
That's all I want to see, man, is MacGruber. Just because...
Okay.
Did you see the review that the Atlantic Monthly gave it?
No, I didn't
see
any
reviews. Oh, my God, dude, it was glowing. It's
was
on
it?
The standee. And the glowing review of the film. But any movie that includes has this line, I said it last week on the show, I took a double decker in the bathroom upstairs. You know, that's all we're saying. That's right there. That's pure cinema. That's as good as you
can get. I know. And that double decker's probably named MacGruber.
Yeah. All right. Is there any summer movie that you're looking forward to? Before we start this Kevin Pollak interview, is there anything?
You know, there's movies that I'm going to go see. There's nothing I'm dying to see. Maybe I don't know enough about what's coming out. I think I do, though. I mean, it's just there's nothing that really ignites my curiosity.
Nothing that lifts your skirt?
No. No, nothing, really.
I'm going to say that it's August for me is Scott Pilgrim and The Expendables. That's what I'm looking forward to after Iron Man 2, in all honesty. Those are the two that I'm... Oh, and the new Lisa Chalodenko film, The Kids Are All Right. I want to see that.
Polanski, the latest on Polanski is they will not sentence him in absence of he has to be in court for them to sentence him. So it's back in the Swiss's hands on what they're doing with that case, if they're going to extradite him or not.
Mm-hmm.
On and on and on and on. There's also some interesting news. I forgot. I was going to bring it up. I can't remember.
What?
Well, man, Jerry, why can't you read my mind, man?
I can't read your mind, dude. That's a tall order, man. I can't do that. Chris can. Chris knows.
How to Tame Your Dragon came in first place again this weekend.
Mm-hmm. What
the backup plan came in second.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the new J-Lo debacle.
Dude, she made one truly great film with Clooney, Out of Sight. That was the one. That's the one she'll be remembered for.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. If she's remembered for a good movie, that'll be the one.
You don't think? I don't think Anaconda, but you know, that's just me.
Always close to my heart, Anaconda.
No, it's a good movie. False advertising, but it was good. But I mean,
that's my MacGruber right there.
But it is a fun movie. There's no doubt about that. But I just like Out of Sight. You know, I'm just like a softy for Out of Sight. So sorry.
So might Charles Grodin actually be in? Midnight Run sequel?
Has he talked? I thought he was retired.
I did too, but...
Is he talking about it? I mean...
Here's something from Anna Cool. Seems the multiple and widely believed reports of Charles Grodin's absence from the picture are not entirely accurate. Agent Mosley indicates that while the sequel isn't specifically about the Grodin character, he is in the script and is instrumental in the sequel storyline. Okay, this agent, Alonzo Mosley guy, is some kind of person that's throwing in a tip to Ain't It Cool News.
Okay.
It's also a character from the first film.
Right, I remember, yeah. I love the first film. It's definitely.
I love the first film, too. We were talking about Martin Brest the other day, and that's another great film.
I think that's my favorite Martin Brest film, more so than even Beverly Hills Cop.
And, you know, we were also talking about, when we were talking about Nicolas Cage, the movie we ran over was, that we forgot, the decent movie was Matchstick Man. I like that movie, too.
I like that movie. You know who's, I like Sam Rockwell in that movie a lot. I like Matchstick Man. I don't know why people hate that movie, but...
Yeah, I think it's fine. I think it's good. Anyway, let's get to the interview. Kevin Pollak. We like Kevin Pollak in so many things.
Mm-hmm.
the Avalon Casino, A Few Good Men. I mean, he's worked with some great directors, and before that, obviously, he made his mark as a comedian. And, man, I tried my best to get him to do a walk-in impression in this thing.
You did, man.
It just didn't work. It just didn't happen. Sorry, guys.
Okay.
But he did join us to talk about a little bit about his film career and his chat show, and especially his new web series, which is called Vamped Out. And you can find it at babblegum.com, that's babblegum.com/vampedout. Here's Kevin. Tell me about your relationship with the web, because, of course, through your talk show, which is extremely popular, and it's terrific. I watch it all the time, and so does Jerry. And now with Vamped Out, tell me about the appeal of doing things on the web for you.
You know, I started out in stand-up comedy where I had that sort of complete creative control. Mm-hmm. And as a stand-up, you know, on stage, you're living and dying by your own wits moment to moment. So a lot of times comedians find it very hard to switch over to film or TV because you're a gun for hire with very little to no say, and it's all not live.
Right.
So... and also as a comedian, you know, you're the writer, the editor, the performer, the director, the choreographer. You have that creative control over
right.
all those things. So suddenly from doing the Kevin Pollak's chat show, I should mention the 2010 Streamy Award winning Kevin Pollak.
Yes, congratulations on that.
It's not important. Anyway, so I sort of rediscovered a milieu wherein I had creative control mm-hmm. and living and dying by my own wits
mm-hmm.
Sort of thing. And also there's that aspect of the web where if you build it, they will come. It's sort of the ultimate version of that, too,
right.
because... it's unbelievably important, two rules I found, abjectly important, to involve your audience, to engage them, to make them feel a part of the process. And then the other thing would be to not self-promote beyond your means, to let the audience discover the
right.
thing. So naturally I'm self-promoting slightly obnoxiously on Twitter, but otherwise, you know, you for most things you don't gear up some giant marketing machine the way you do
right.
traditional media.
Well, it is kind of a unique communication between entertainer and audience that the web presents. And of course, as a stand-up, you get that immediate feedback. Movies,
yeah.
you know, you do your work 6 months, a year later, you'll get the feedback
yeah.
when it finally comes
yeah.
out. Where does your work on the web fit in that?
We sat down to lunch with Jason Antoon, we being Jamie, my better half, and I, about 6 months ago.
Right.
Having seen a billboard for The Vampire Diaries with the hilarious tagline, "Love sucks." We're still laughing over that one. We were sat down bemoaning this ridiculous thing. And Antoon says, "Could you imagine being a vampire right now and you can't get hired to be in any of these movies or TV shows?" And we all started laughing, and then Jamie said, "Kevin, that would be a great bit for your act." And I said, I think it would be a great web series. And I wasn't looking to do a web series at that point. I don't know why I didn't say, "Hey, that'd be a great short film." But then I said that would be a great web series. And Jason and I started writing a week later, and within 3 weeks we had a readable version of these six scripts. So that was all 5 to 6 months ago. And now here we are talking about the series being on babblegum.com. So that's the quickest turnaround I've ever experienced from inception to release.
And you're like an ultra hyphenate lately. especially with this project. I mean, you're co-producing, co-writing, directing for the first time. Was that always in acting, of course, but... Was directing always kind of a curiosity for you?
I don't know. I mean, I'd been asked to direct a couple of features, but it was somebody else's script, and I just didn't respond to the material. as wildly enticing as that notion was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote a screenplay just so I could compete with my my gardener. Because his script was fantastic.
Okay.
So, no, but I had been toying with the idea of directing a feature now for several years, one that I had written. And I found the experience to be beyond as rewarding as I had hoped.
Well, what surprised you about yourself and that role of director?
What surprised me? I would say that people seem to be responding to my demands, and that's always surprising. I would say the surprising part was how much I enjoyed it and how well I was told I took to it from the get-go. I mean, one of the things I'd learned from working with all these great directors over the years was that, you know, the mood on the set is definitely set by the director. The fish stinks from the head down, and you had better have an unbelievably happy set.
Right.
And I enjoyed all of that as sort of the ringmaster, but also the court jester, you know, which is how I sort of, the court jester part is how I work on every set as an actor. And I thought, well, I'll take that to the set as the director and see if that works. And I just know that a happy set is a very, very productive one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So. True.
Well, you have, as you mentioned, you have worked with some of the great directors. And I wanted to ask you about two in particular. And sure. What you possibly took from them and learned from them and your experience with them. Barry Levinson is one.
Okay, one at a time. Barry, very, very fortunate for me that he was the director of the first real drama that I did as an actor in Avalon. Because I say very fortunate for two reasons. One, he loves comedians, whether they're trained actors or not. And two, since I was that, a stand-up with no training as an actor, the fact that I was working my first time in a big drama with a director who hated acting and didn't ever want a scene to seem anything other than spontaneous, that was just crazy good luck for me.
That's wild. Great luck, yeah.
So in terms of the experience, there was that part. But then for him as a guy who hated acting, that was an unusual thing. So I just remember watching how he went about capturing spontaneity and what he did to relax his actors in the scene. And I called him the Phantom. And I've joked about this with other actors who've been in this movie. In fact, I had Danny Stern on the chat show a couple of weeks ago, and we laughed about this in the episode. But his experience was the same, that Barry would set up a scene. His brilliance is writing and casting, as I found a lot of the better directors either do the writing or find a great script or help rewrite it into a great script. And then it's just about the casting. And then you get out of the way and let the actors do what they do and the reason you hired them. The reason you chose them, you know, that's the hard part. So then I got from Barry to just kind of stay out of the way.
So is he one of those guys that kind of, you refer to him as the Phantom, but does that also have to do with he's guiding you a certain way to achieve a certain goal and you don't feel that guidance necessarily?
Yes. I don't remember ever getting direction the entire experience. I mean, if he were directing this scene, he would say, "All right, Kevin, you're at home, you're on the phone there, and fellas, you're in the studio, you got your headphones on, and you're talking and action." And then he would go behind the monitor and laugh with his headphones on, and then he would say, "Cut," and then he would come back over. That was astounding.
Wow.
Okay, we'll do it again. So, Kevin, you're there, and you've got the cat is near you, and then the guys, you're in the studio, and you. There's no cat and action. So it was never really any faster, slower, louder, softer, you know.
Right, right.
Okay, good.
And, of course, Scorsese, I mean, the giant that anyone would be lucky to be in the vicinity of, and the whole casino experience. What was that like for you?
Well, not too dissimilar in the sense that the actors had complete freedom, which I found shocking. A guy who's so meticulous about every square inch of his frame, his composition, within that composition, the actors were literally free to do whatever they wanted. And then after every take, he would come by and say, "Well, that was great. That was great. What do you think? Should be more angry, less frustrated? What do you think?" And I just quickly learned you had better have an answer to that barrage of inquiries as to what you might want to do next. But it was questions. It wasn't instructions. So you felt a part of his process instantly, which was magnificent.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be a really, I mean, just listening to the man talk, it has to be a very energetic feeling on a Scorsese set.
Yes, and or exhausting, depending on your day. Yeah. Now and he's also the greatest film reference guide in human form. That
I think so,
written.
Yeah.
Every sentence is riddled with references to films you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a constant education happening if you're inclined. But no, he was a very fascinating ball of energy, and you did all you could to keep up with him. And you felt like you were in the presence of true original greatness that doesn't exist elsewhere.
Yeah. Right. Now, I know that you've probably been asked this question a million times, so I'm going to ask you once more. Casino versus Goodfellas. There's this big argument.
We've
had it
last night.
I know, we've had this argument so often on the show. And what is your take on it? Because Casino, I feel like it got kind of a bad rap upon its release, and it's gained in stature as the years have gone by. And a lot of that probably has to do with Goodfellas. Is that your take on it? What were your feelings about that?
First of all, I've not been asked this a million times, so...
Okay.
Sorry to disappoint, and yet quite a relief for me, because I like this question a lot. And I think that you're hitting the proverbial nail on its head. Goodfellas, argue as you may about some of his other films, Raging Bull, Goodfellas is, in my opinion, Scorsese's masterpiece. So anything in its similar genre would only be compared to that.
Right.
Scorsese is one of those rare filmmakers that all of his films are compared to only his films and not other films.
Right, yeah.
Woody Allen the same. There's a few people, filmmakers like this, where you only compare it to their previous work.
Right.
As whether it's good or bad, as opposed to comparing it to what's out at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if Goodfellas hadn't existed, I would dare say Casino would be Scorsese's masterpiece. But because Goodfellas existed prior,
mm-hmm.
For some, Casino was just returning to the scene of the crime. Oh, this again. And then it has to pale in comparison because it's being compared to his masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is what it is. You can't get away from that.
Well, let me give you my take on it, because I know that you're incredibly curious about what my take must be.
I'm just writing that down. Must remember to ask your take.
Goodfellas and Casino, I kind of put them in terms of Godfather and Godfather 2.
Right.
Godfather is a perfect film, but I will watch Godfather 2 probably first, because it just feels like so much... It's such a richer, kind of more delicious experience to me. And I feel the same way with Goodfellas in comparison, or Casino in comparison to Goodfellas. Does that make any sense to you?
Perfect.
Oh, my God. It makes all the sense in the world. Where do we begin? No, you know, I was just asked in a previous interview to give my top five films, which I just launched into, you know, because it was put to me, like, if you were a professor instead of an actor of film, and you had to teach a course, what would be the... And you only had five films to teach it with, what would they be? And I said, well, if this were the curriculum, first of all, it would take considerably more time than you've allowed me to put my list together. And in this situation, you know, what I said to that person was, I'm going to go against the norm and actually pick Godfather 2 in my top 5 instead of Godfather 1. And one of the main reasons is because it is the lone exception to the rule that the sequel's never better.
Right.
Or as good.
Right.
So whether it's good or better, it depends on the fan.
Right, of course.
But it is one or the other, and that doesn't exist in sequels ever. Although I will say, Grumpier Old Man was right up in.
Of course.
It doesn't exist. So to suggest that Casino is as good or better than Goodfellas, that would be an argument that may go down to the death.
Mm-hmm, right.
Depending on who you're having it with.
Right.
That's a debatable point of view that is, for true film lovers, a debate worth having.
Yeah. Well, I find that we're in total agreement on that.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You are my new best friend.
Well, we all tend to agree with people who agree with us, don't we?
Can we
go ahead, Jerry.
Film? Can we bring up, there's actually, I wonder, because we are talking about your films. There's one film I'm very fond of, and that's where you play the President of the United States, Rod Laurie's Deterrence. And I think that's an exceptional film, way ahead of its time. And you were just wonderful on that. And I was just curious what that experience was like for you.
Thank you, first of all. I think as tight little political thrillers go, it's one of the better ones, and it's certainly one of the best performances I've ever given, and one of the least seen. So I always appreciate anyone who's even seen the damn thing. As well as movies that was shot for Coffee and Donuts and first time writer director,
mm-hmm.
and we're lucky to get a release from Paramount Classics. But of course, when I'm number one on the call sheet, the studio is only going to spend so much money in marketing. So no one really had a chance to find out about the film, let alone see it.
Right.
It was wildly unfortunate because, for me, unfortunate. Not so much for the writer-director who went on to do The Contender and got a couple Academy Award nominations for his actors. And that's really a remarkable film, I think.
Yeah.
So, I love the movie Deterrence, and
mm-hmm.
I would, anyone who loves a tight political thriller, I would encourage them with great vigor to go see it.
Yeah. So saying that, because you talked about this studio and it didn't get I mean, I think it played at one. I live outside of Washington D.C. and I think it played at one theater here for like a week or so when it opened.
Yeah.
And
it sounds about right.
Yeah. So you would, I would think with the web though, one of the great things is you get rid of all that the studio interference, or you have much more control over how the series is going to get out there. You can put it out there immediately if you can, as soon as you're done shooting. So I would think this is the freedom, as you mentioned earlier, with the web is just unlimited.
Yeah, it's been a perfect experience. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. From 100% abject creative control and freedom to the short span of 5 months or so from conception to us talking about it being viewable now.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist. But also coming from stand-up comedy, where I have always been, as any comedian is, the writer, the editor, the director, the producer, the choreographer,
right.
the performer, you know, and being feeling like a gun for hire in films and TV for the most part. So all those are the reasons. And then you know, I love being in this wild frontier, quite
mm-hmm.
frankly, of original content online, because it runs a complete gambit. It's a great place for kids to start out and throwing up anything.
Right.
It's also a place where you can watch a cat play a piano along with 10 million other people. And that's perfect. You know, I don't find fault with any of it. It's literally, if you build it, they will come. And if they don't, then you need to rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got one of our favorite people in Vamped Out.
Yeah,
Sam Levine. He's been on our show 3 times in the past. And we're crazy about him. He's hysterical in it.
Yeah, he really is great. There's a small film coming out that he's in that I highly recommend called Drones.
Mm-hmm.
And he's exceptional in that as well. Yeah, Sam is a great talent, and we've enjoyed having him on my talk show, Kevin Pollak's Chat Show.
The Streamy Award-winning.
That's right. Yeah. The 2010 Streamy Award, Kevin Pollak's Chat Show. And Sam is a bit of a sidekick on the show and has been from the beginning. And, yeah, he's a tremendous talent. He really is.
Speaking of your chat show, and this is the last question, and then we'll let you go unless Jerry wanted to pop in here with something else. But I mean, we love your chat show, as billions of people do, I'm sure. But do you have a dream guest?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, they're endless. I mean, we've had some big-timers on. We've had 5 Academy Award winners on, captains of industry, in the case of Elon Musk, the CEO and founder of Tesla Motors. The no time restraints and no censorship has allowed us to spend a couple hours with people like Seth MacFarlane, Kevin Smith,
right?
Eddie Izzard holding the record at 2 hours and 31 minutes. So along with all those things in the back, because we book the show ourselves,
mm-hmm.
It's very fine line-ish as to who I reach out to and who I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And as proud as I am of the show and as much as we've accomplished in a scant year, I'm still very reluctant to reach out to a lot of the giant A-listers that I've worked with and in some cases are good friends with. But people are now starting to offer themselves up to the show, which has kind of been the fantasy all along.
Right.
But Albert Brooks comes to mind, Ricky Gervais, some of you more genius comedic brains. But also, you know, we've had great filmmakers on already, and Jason Reitman and Chris McQuarrie, the aforementioned Academy Award-winning writer of The Usual Suspects.
Right, right.
And Kevin Smith and George Gallo, who wrote Midnight Run. I love to have some of the great filmmakers that I've worked with on the show. I just haven't had the balls to pick up the phone and call them. It's funny how that works, you know. But anyways, there you go.
Well, I would love to see you interview Christopher Walken as Christopher Walken. I think that would be your first 4-hour show.
Well, that's more of a sketch than a moment of reality. I have found that doing them for them is not always a great idea. Although in his case, he does like it. We
that's good, as long as he likes it.
Become friendly over the years. But to conduct an interview as him would be slightly obnoxious after about 3 minutes.
But he even asked you to present his star on the Walk of Fame to him. Is that right?
It was a bigger event than even that. It was the hands and feet and signature in cement in front of the Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, which is a considerably greater honor these days. A, they're running out of real estate, and B, you can pretty much get a star on the Walk of Fame now for about $1,500. I mean, Ryan Seacrest has one. Should I go on?
No.
Oh, wow. I had no idea. Wow.
But the hands and feet of the cement is huge. And so, yes, I was one of the two speakers at the ceremony, the other one being Quentin Tarantino, who directed him in Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
And I had never met Christopher Walken prior to this. So as honored as I was being asked, I couldn't help wonder, well, how far down the list did he have to go?
I guess he had seen you do an impression of him or something and invited you based on that, or?
Yeah, I had done it on Conan O'Brien several times, and you know, you just never know who sees it, is all I can tell you. But I had a sense that people might have helped him put the guest list together. I don't know that he personally selected me. I didn't hear yes or no on that, but I have my questions, but I did not pose to him.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for your time today, and I love Vamped Out. We both do. We love your show, and wish you the best of luck with everything.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much. Yeah, I'm annoyingly proud of this little web series, and for some bizarre reason, it's the best reviews of my career, literally, and that makes me happy as well that I found this new home and original content online, and it's going so well so quickly.
Well, we'll definitely drive our traffic your way at the show. So.
Much appreciated.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right, thank you.
All right, so tell everyone to head to babblegum.com.
Exactly, yes.
That's right.
All right, 2010 Streamy Award winner. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kevin.
Please, it's not important.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, Kevin Pollack, babblegum.com/vampedout to see his new web series. And, of course, the Kevin Pollack chat show as well. Jerry?
Yeah, I'm here, man.
Okay, all right.
Here. You know what, dude? Chris, in his infinite wisdom, reminded us that we forgot to talk about Inception. And it's not so much that we forgot to talk about it. It's like I'm trying to make sure I know nothing about the film before walking into it, because I have a feeling once people start talking about this movie online before it comes out, I mean, it sounds like a very intriguing premise. I don't want to spoil it because it's Chris Nolan. So I mean,
yeah,
I don't.
I think I think it's going to be a real mind bender. I think I would hope that Chris Nolan is working in conjunction with the Warner Brothers marketing to make sure that not too much is revealed.
Yeah, I hope
because
not.
Because it seems like that would be important to him.
It's going to be very important for this film.
And it sticks out like a sore thumb, really, in the glut of suburb blockbusters.
Here's the thing about summer blockbusters is it's going to be a lot of 3D animated films, it looks like. It's going to be a lot of kiddie films. Like, I mean, does anyone really care about Shrek at this point? I mean, I know people do, but does anyone really, really care what happens to the ogre at this point? I mean, unless it's going to be...
Chris, call in, dude.
I thought he was going to call in. Why? I thought he was going to be on the line. I
don't know. I'm not on my switch.
I mean, you got the Prince of Persia. I don't know about that. As much as I like Jake Gyllenhaal,
that hasn't come out yet.
No, that comes out the end of May, dude. You really? Oh, I'm worried about you. I think. I think you need to start drinking heavily, man. That's all.
I've been in a coma, man.
I think you need to start drinking heavily. That's all I'm going to suggest.
I don't think anybody will notice when Prince of Persia comes out.
Honestly. I don't know. I mean. It does seem, because I remember reading this thing, I guess, in the Wrap or wherever, that with the exception of Iron Man 2, there weren't many sequels. There wasn't a lot of name brand recognition. I mean, obviously, yeah, you have the A-Team and stuff, but there's going to be a lot of other films, too. And it's the smaller films I'm really looking forward to, like the Lisa Shalodinka film, The Kids Are All Right. I really want to see that. And also the other one, Cyrus, which I think, is that directed by the Duplass brothers, or...
Yeah.
Isn't okay, because
yeah.
Looks. Oh my God, Jonah Hill just looks annoying as hell in that movie, but I do want to see it though, because I like them. Call in, dude. Please call in, Chris. Thank you.
I haven't seen. I was going to watch it the other night, the new Neil Jordan movie, and I haven't gotten around to it.
That looks really good. I can't wait to see that.
Supposed to watch like Casino Jack. I haven't gotten in. Supposed to have that guy
dude,
Tuesday
that
afternoon.
Awesome. I saw a trailer for that the other day. That looks incredible.
The documentary, not the Kevin Spacey.
I wasn't thinking of the Kevin Spacey. I was thinking of the... I saw... God damn it, Jamie. You got to think a little bit higher of me there. I mean, yeah, I'm
well, there's two projects at the same time.
I know, but this is the trailer, though, for the documentary. It looks very fascinating.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, I was involved in a Casino Jack one time, and they threw me out.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they made a documentary about it. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
What's new with you? Have you seen anything recently?
No, I haven't seen anything this weekend. I didn't think there was anything really worth seeing. But last movie I went and saw was Kick-Ass.
Mm-hmm.
Not interested in the backup plan at all.
I don't think anyone's really.
Really?
Yeah. Why are you?
Yeah.
Please tell me you're being facetious when you say that to Chris and I. I mean, why would you think that?
Yeah.
I mean,
It's clearly a joke, dude.
I know, but it's just the way it comes out. I don't know, the humor is missing in the tone there, but Chris would know better than
I would be much more interested in seeing Jennifer Lopez in her panties literally backing up towards the camera for 2 hours.
Then what?
That would be my plan. That would be my backup plan for J-Lo.
Yeah.
So the losers pretty much lost in the box office too. Like nobody's.
Yeah, it's How to Train Your Dragon's really the big winner.
Kids movies, man. I mean, and that's why I'm not counting out the Shrek, the fourth Shrek movie.
Oh, I'm not counting it out. I just, as each sequel's come out, I've lost interest. I thought the first one was, I do think the first one's a really good movie, but it just, each sequel it loses, it's, a lot's lost in each sequel, like a Xerox copy or whatever.
Yeah, very, very true with that particular set of movies. I think the same will probably be true of the Toy Story movie, too, to be perfectly honest with you. It's just how many times can you go back to the same well? Mm-hmm. I know we all love Pixar, and I know I sound like the biggest idiot on the earth for betting against Pixar, but I can't think of an example of a movie series of any kind with any filmmaker where three times and it still felt relevant.
You know what I think? I think Toy Story 3 is going to be the biggest hit of the summer.
Well, I'm not talking about whether or not it's going to be a hit. I agree with you.
Right.
I'm sure it will be the biggest hit of the summer.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I don't think that it'll be as compelling as the first two.
And I think that and Shrek the Fourth are coming out too close together, actually.
But I think they'll both.
They'll both exceed.
I mean, it's a 3D component that's really.
Toy Story will win the battle.
Oh, I think so. I definitely think so. Chris, I'm with you there. There's something about I do like the first two Toy Stories, but this one's just not doing anything for me. I mean, you're right. You're just going back to the well, and
I mean, did Toy Story 2, when you saw trailers for example. When you saw trailers and stuff for Toy Story 2, did that do anything for you before you actually sat down and watched it?
No, absolutely not. But I'm not even talking about the trailer.
Okay, go ahead, Chris.
I'm just generally talking about there being about sequels and diminishing returns. I honestly have not even seen a full trailer for Toy Story 3. I've only seen like the first teaser that came out 6 months ago or something like that.
I'm looking forward to it, and it's the return of Michael Keaton.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, he was
the Kindle.
I know that. He was in post grad. I didn't see you running out to see that.
Or first daughter or whatever the.
Come on, he's been there. He's working. He's earning a paycheck. I don't see talking about those films.
Isn't he in a new Sandler movie too?
Wait, he's in Grown Ups.
If it's not Grown Ups, it's something else. But I do think he's in a new Sandler movie.
Wait, Sandler has something else besides Grown Ups?
Speaking of a series, yes, Sandler's always got something. Speaking of a series of films, they're up to the 23rd film now, and the Bond series, I think it's 23. And it's been postponed because MGM can't afford it.
Well,
good.
It's not just that. It's that no one wants to be attached to MGM because if they do really go down the sinkhole this time, Bond goes with it. So they think Sony's probably going to pick it up.
Okay. Well, it's already lost Sam Mendes in the scheduling kerfuffle. Don't you love that word, kerfuffle?
That's probably a good thing.
Hang on. I just want to draw attention to the fact that I just used the word kerfuffle for the first time on the show, and I love
that
word.
Let me put that on Twitter. Let me go ahead and put
it. You have the vocabulary of a 72-year-old man.
That's our word of the day. Yes, I just crapped my kerfuffle. So I feel no great sense of loss with a missing Bond picture.
Well, hopefully, I hope Daniel Craig will stay with it. I hope he's not going to walk away, but I don't think it's going to. I think we're looking at a period like in 1989 to 1995. I think that's what we're looking at, quite honestly.
Nah, he's got to be getting bored, right? I mean, this guy's a serious actor. I like Pierce Brosnan and Sean Connery as much as the next guy. But neither one of them had the kind of chops. Like, neither one of them could pull off the sort of performance that that Daniel Craig pulled off in Infamous. Could you see Pierce Brosnan or Sean Connery pulling off that kind of performance?
No.
He is much the best actor that's ever played Bond, and I don't even like his Bond movies.
I agree with you that he's the best actor to play Bond. And I actually like both movies. I realize the second one plays more like an extended third act of the first one. But I do like both of them. And if they reboot this thing again, they're just as dumb as the Spider-Man people. And that's what they're talking about. There is a serious talk that this is going to be rebooted once again.
A reboot.
And I'm getting sick of it. I really...
How can you reboot something?
Boot it.
Yeah.
I think we're looking at a period where... what's happened is MGM is really... Now, MGM... Let me ask you guys this. MGM has been, through this whole decade, MGM has been on the verge of financial collapse. We keep reading about it. Now they're finally at that point where it does look like it's over, and even their library can't save them, and they have one of the greatest film libraries you could have, and that can't save them. There's talk that Sony is going to get Bond. That's what all lights point to Sony. But even with that, I wish they would make another one, but it's just not – I don't see it happening. I think Bond is going to be on ice for a while.
I think so, too.
All I can say is good. I just don't have any desire. Maybe I'm a stick in the mud, but
it's so
difficult to believe that people still get excited about these movies.
Well, I think what they did with Casino Royale is, well, and also we have the Jason Bourne movies to thank for that. It's really the Bourne identity revitalized James Bond, which is ironic, but that's how it happens. But
I'm wondering what's going on with UA too, since Tom Cruise took over. I mean that hasn't performed well either. I mean MGM UA. But.
Well, maybe Michael Cimino will come back and rob UA of whatever they have left.
Yeah. Woody Allen announced his next movie, which is odd because he never announces a title or details about a movie before he makes it. But his next movie is called Midnight in Paris. It's another international kind of thing with Kathy Bates and Michael Sheen.
Wow.
Will they be the couple spending midnight in Paris together? I have no idea.
Do we know what this is even about yet? Or
It also stars Owen Wilson, Marion Cotillard, and Rachel McAdams.
Dude, he always gets the greatest cast.
I was assuming it was going to have Paris Hilton in it.
Midnight in Paris, it's great.
Yeah, that's classic, man.
I like that show, Chris.
As Kevin Pollak would say, it's not important.
There you go.
Man, I tried for that Chris Walken impression, Chris. I wanted it.
Yeah, he was funny. Believe me, that was the first time I had heard it, and I found him very, very funny, regardless of whether or not he did the impression. So
okay.
It was
all
a good
right.
interview.
Oh, thank you, buddy. We have somebody, I think, Dean on the line. Oh, hang on, Chris, you must be excited about this upcoming weekend at the movies.
This upcoming weekend, what the hell comes out this upcoming weekend?
Nightmare on Elm Street, the remake.
I'm blanking. Oh, yes. Well, you'll be happy to know that our old friend Brandon is coming into town the night that Nightmare on Elm Street airs, and he and I, no one else will give a shit about this, but Jamie knows Brandon, and We're old high school buddies that always watched those movies together. We're old roommates. We used to sit around and watch the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. So yes, I'm very, very excited about it. I will be buying my tickets in a couple days, and I know that I'll probably be disappointed, but I like a good Freddy movie. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm interested that there's no reviews leaked of the movie yet. There's a couple test reviews that were leaked, but there have been no reputable reviews.
Right.
Coming out on the movie, which is never a good sign.
Maybe they haven't screened it for critics.
Has it been screened yet?
Yeah.
Well,
that's never a good sign. That's what I'm saying.
It could be screened on a Tuesday or something, so they can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm not expecting it to score a 93 on Rotten Tomatoes or anything.
No.
Plus,
that's not really
a screen.
But it's the casting here of Freddy that's key. It's a very interesting. I mean, Jackie Earle Haley is Freddy Krueger is, I'd hate to think that little children is typecasting, but it's still very inspired casting.
It is sort of weird that he's decided to play two pedophiles.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd make that move. It would be akin to Christoph Waltz announcing that he's going to play a Nazi again. It would be like, well, really?
Well, a lot more people are going to see his pedophile in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Which would be the reason for him to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's taking over an iconic kind of character.
He's gonna. You do have to wonder if it's gonna work, though.
Well, let me ask you this: it's not gonna be a funny. The humor, at least from the trailer, I can't see there being much humor as was developed throughout the series as the series went on. This is gonna be played like serious, as what Rob Zombie did with the first Halloween remake.
They say the fan reviews that I've read of it say that it still has humor in it, but not to the extent that it became so jokey as the series continued. Where Freddy Krueger was a punchline.
The first two or three movies. Yeah, the first two or three movies weren't like that. That didn't start until the fourth, fifth.
That's right.
So.
Where everything had to be a punchline before he kills somebody. Yeah.
Right.
I'm curious if either of you have seen Avatar on Blu-ray.
No, I haven't
seen the 2D Avatar on Blu-ray, no.
It was an interesting thing because I wonder if the whole if part of the idea of him releasing it with absolutely no special features and not on 3D was sort of a test to see how the movie would truly be judged. I mean, you literally have to watch it. When you're watching it, it's interesting because you have to judge it based on the movie alone.
Right.
It looks amazing on Blu-ray. It really does. Like, it's probably the best looking Blu-ray I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
But you do miss the 3D watching it. I will say that. Like, anyway, I did because the 3D was so astounding.
Right.
But I do think that it holds up pretty well. Feels a little longer on DVD on Blu-ray without the three dimensions, especially in that closing battle. You know,
right.
The movie's hitting the 2.5 hour mark. It helps to still have some amazing visuals, 3D visuals to look at. But I gotta say, like, I'm pretty impressed with the way it looks on Blu-ray.
I bet it looks astounding.
I bet what I would hope. It's still, regardless of the, without the features and everything, it broke every, I think, record on DVD Blu-ray record.
And there will be, like, the Uber edition, the Uber Nerd edition, with a Navi dictionary coming out in December or whatever.
I bet that'll happen, too. I bet that Navi dictionary will come out. Has that been announced, or are you joking?
No, that's not what I was joking, but there is a Navi dictionary. I don't think you can purchase it, but you can go online and read it.
Mm. Okay, let's take Dean's phone call. Let me see if I can get to the screen. I've got so many screens up in my... they're doing Iron Man...
for porn again? Shit, man.
They're doing Iron Man 2 press big time now, too. That's two
right.
weeks from now, right?
That's only less than 2 weeks away, so...
Sorry, Dean. I'm trying to get to the screen. Oh, he's gone. Okay. Okay.
Not so much for that. Okay.
What else is going on? Anything else we want to talk about?
I think
I'm trying
to think of anything. Unless there's something Chris wants to talk about. I mean,
I'm trying to find some more
now,
news.
It does shock me that neither one of you are interested in a Alien sequel, though. I gotta say,
Don't you think this prequel, though, is just a devoid of any... It's what I was talking about with Aaron a couple of years ago on the show about the silly Clone Wars movie. I mean, have we gotten to a point where we need everything explained, backstory explained to us? I mean, it sort of robs you of your imagination of these events. Let my own perception
of
what happened.
Why are you excited about it, Chris?
15 minutes ago, you were talking about how much you loved Casino Royale, and that's exactly what Casino Royale did.
Here's the thing. If Casino Royale could have massively bombed, too, but it is by Daniel Craig. I'm just not... The problem I have with the Alien prequel and where he's pinpointed this thing, okay, this is a ship, that creature or whatever that was on the ship in the first Alien... I don't feel I need that, and if it was something more about Ripley, I would be interested, but it's not. It's about...
Yeah, but Ripley was what the first five were, or
yeah.
four were
yeah,
all
about. Yeah,
you
got like 500 years of movies about Ripley. Like,
yeah, but I mean, but I just can't get worked up over this. This is, and there is a bias with Casino Royale because I do love Bond. And I love what they did with it, with those two movies. I really do. It reminded me of what Bond should have been all along.
Well, what about Batman? What about, Batman Begins? They did it well there. I do feel like if you do it with the right script and the right director, there's no problem with it.
This is where it comes in. If Steven Sommers were directing an Alien prequel...
Right.
I'd feel ho-hum about it. The only reason why I have any tingle at all about an Alien prequel is Ridley Scott's return to that series.
I'm going to go see it, but it's what they've decided to pinpoint, that particular thing. That never really was like how that came to be. I don't need that. I would be interested in the lives of the crew members of the Nostromo. That is interesting to me, but that's not what it's going to be. But
lives of the crew member, the Nostromo, like they first, you saw them meet the aliens. So if you go and like make a movie about Ellen Ripley prior to the events of the first Alien movie, it's just going to be a movie about a chick living on Earth. Like,
yeah,
I mean, it's like
no, that's, I, mean, I just I just don't have an interest. Also, I'll be honest, I don't have an that my interest in that series in that regard into its past. Into its past, I don't really have the same interest that I do have in the James Bond or the Batman prequels. But I like the James Bond and the Batman reboots. Forgive me, they're reboots, not prequels or whatever you want to. I don't even know that. I get lost.
Well, they are reboots, and they go a long way to exactly do that, to reinvent it as something to take seriously. The Dark Knight works because it's a crime film more than a comic book film.
No, what I like, though, is they both these characters. It's like what Bond is in Casino Royale is what we were like led to believe when our fathers read these books or didn't. Kind of what they were about, and as those series both, and the Batman. Look, I'm not a big fan of the first four Batman films. I'm not. I thought the first Batman film was really overrated. I really love what Chris Nolan did with Batman Begins. It was like when I was watching it, I turned to my mom and I said, "Yes, this is what it's supposed to be like. This is what Batman is supposed to be. This is what Bob Kane had envisioned. This is what Frank Miller did with it." And that's what I felt like with James Bond, that with Casino Royale, returned it to its pulpy roots that it had, and that's what I liked about those. I just can't get worked up about an Alien prequel from what I've been told so far.
To me, the Casino Royale movie, like, it didn't really show. I don't even know why we're calling it a reboot. Yes, it was a new movie with Daniel Craig. Like, there was a new person playing Bond, but it's not like you saw him becoming Bond or anything. Like, I mean, he became 007. Like, he got the title 007. But didn't we always assume that he just, like, got pissed off and, or he was, like, some sort of agent and then got put in the Her Majesty's Secret Service? Like, didn't we always assume that?
No,
like, there was no real story there. There's no real reason. He didn't become anything. You know, he didn't transform into Bond.
I disagree
with
that.
He's on a mission, and at the end of the movie, he's the same agent. Like, I mean, like,
kind
he's an agent
same.
At
he's
the beginning and the end of
instrument.
That movie.
Still that blunt instrument. But in the series, we're always, you know, we learn these new things. Like, we learn that he was in the Navy. He's Commander Bond. I don't get that with this one.
Who gives a shit?
Chris, I'm sorry, but I'm just telling you my perception of the past, my perception of what Bond is. And when we learn this thing, when he tries on the tuxedo for the first time, and when they do say,
all right, now you're sounding a little gay.
You Bond fans are so gay.
I don't know, Jamie. I mean, let me put it to you like this: when she says to him, M says to him, the reason you're the best poker player in the service, that's why you're getting this. It makes a lot of sense.
I think they really focus more on character in Casino Royale.
Yeah,
but
and that's why I think it works.
I can't get excited after 20 of anything. I missed the carefree Bond that slept with all the ladies, and you know, what I missed from Casino
Bond
Royale.
Is like, he's like crying and getting tortured, and somebody's fucking punching his scrotum like a speed bag, like when. It's fucking awful.
I'm sorry, guys. I think they rescued it from what it was becoming. I really...
Okay,
yeah.
but then it suffers the problem that all reboots do, which is, okay, now you've rebooted it. Now you've got to start this second movie, and it's no longer a reboot. Now you're just doing another Bond sequel. And The Dark Knight solved that problem. I don't think Quantum of Solace did. It was not as big a success at the box office, and it was not received anywhere near as well as
it did. No, it wasn't
obviously,
received well... But I will say this, I like the direction it took, and I'd be curious to see what a third movie would do, although I do feel that Quantum of Solace feels more like an extended third act at Casino Royale more than anything else. But I did like it. I won't lie to you. I liked it, and I do thank God for the Bourne movies for helping reinvent it, because the Bourne movies were just out of this world fantastic as far as
I'm also excited about...
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm also excited about the idea of Alien if it's going to be a thriller again. You know, like you can't. These class of films are hard to categorize, but Alien is often categorized as a horror movie. Like if you look on the top 10 great horror movies of all time, Alien is inevitably on that list.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to another scary Alien movie. Ridley Scott, though, what do you guys think of his Hannibal?
It was not a great book to begin with.
Yeah, I mean,
so there was not. It was not. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it sucked, but it was certainly not Silence of the Lambs material. Like anyone who has read Silence of the Lambs and read Hannibal will recognize that. You know, Silence of the Lambs is an amazing book and made into an amazing movie.
Hmm.
Hannibal was a, you know, decent book that was made into a decent movie. It just didn't have the jumping off point that Silence of the Lambs did. And also, I don't think that Ridley Scott is the kind of director for that particular kind of material. Like, he's never been, he doesn't have that kind of eye that Jonathan Demme has.
Mm-hmm.
Ridley Scott is much better at atmosphere, he's much better at feeling, but he's not necessarily someone who I associate with having a great eye.
He's not somebody that you would go to I mean, he does have, he's an artist, he does have, I think he does have a great eye, but he's not somebody that you'd go to portray a Midwestern story or a Northwestern story, you know, like Silence of the Lambs was. I mean, you felt the location in that movie. I can't tell you where the location was.
Yeah, my problem with Hannibal is that Hannibal, you know, Chris is right, it's a letdown in the sense that it's a book that everyone was, for the longest time, always asking, when's the next Thomas Harris book coming out? When's it? That was
right.
A good 10 years before that book came out, and the book was disappointing, and so it's really hard for the movie tries at times, but I like the scenes in Italy. I thought the scenes in Italy were very good in that. I really got to say I didn't care much for the movie after everything was said and done. It just seemed like it was a long way to go for the Ray Liotta punchline at the end, you know, his character.
Tell you what, the movie takes forever to get started.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a 45-minute prologue before
mm-hmm.
you get to the meat of it.
I also feel like it was definitely wounded by the fact that you didn't have Jodie Foster returning.
Yeah, that hurts
right
there.
I mean, it's very, very... very awkward having someone else play Clarice Starling, you know, in that kind. That's an iconic performance,
mm-hmm.
and it would have been fine. I mean, it wouldn't have been fine if they recast all the parts, but they recast, you know, only her part, and it's like you're supposed to have the same relationship and the same chemistry between these two actors playing the same parts as you did with Jodie Foster, and it does not work that way.
I think it's hard to get that to work, too. I mean, it's just so hard to... To reignite that,
the
film was always going to have this uphill battle, which it doesn't, just can't do.
I was really bothered too by the end of it when he cut off his hand.
Yeah.
Because I didn't understand why he just didn't cut the chain.
Right.
On the handcuffs, that he could have gotten free. He didn't have to cut off his hand. Unless it was some kind of dramatic, you know, I'll give up my hand for you or something like that, which is just silly.
Well, in the book, if I'm not mistaken, in the book, don't they run off together?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was no way you could do that. I don't know why, but there's no way you could do that in the movie. But
and that is the main reason why Jodie Foster said no. I mean, she felt that it majorly, reading the book, she felt it betrayed Clarice.
It did. And it's just, it's just not believable. It's not believable as it is, as it's written. It's just, and as the movie is filmed, it's not believable that the Hannibal character would go so far out of his way to contact Clarice Starling. I mean, yes, he liked her. Like,
right.
Maybe this is just my perception of it. I definitely felt like he liked her, but wouldn't go to the extent that he did in the movie and in the book. I did like the Mason Berger character and that storyline, though.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that worked. The one thing in the book and the movie that came close to attaining the level of the first movie was the Mason Berger story.
Right.
Right.
And Gary Oldman.
And the fact that Gary Oldman played it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, although you wouldn't know.
That's true. Gary Oldman, he needs to get back in the game, man.
Seriously.
I mean, the last great high-profile Gary Oldman was what, The Contender?
Well, I mean, Gary Oldman. I mean, technically it would be Dark Knight, but the last one that was high profile.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
And a,
good in those, but yeah, you're right. The contender really, well, the contender, yeah, would be the last one.
In terms of the, and he's great in The Dark Knight. I mean, he's great in a way that he's unexceptional. Like, not
right.
maybe that's not the right way of putting it, but he just is. I mean, he just is there in the movie. It's, there's no showboating. It's not, it doesn't feel like a performance. He is what that character is,
right.
Just a sturdy, constant presence. But in terms of the versatile chameleon Gary Oldman that we all love, it was the contender.
Mm-hmm.
And he's. I saw an interview with him on Charlie Rose when he was talking about The Contender and talking about how he's so behind his character in The Contender, and he thinks the resolution of the movie is wrong, and that his character was right. And you know, that was interesting. I didn't expect that, but almost you should with an actor, because their job is to sympathize with their character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sympathize with that journey. So I remember in high school, just Gary Oldman was the great, was the new brand, was the new
De Niro,
Pacino. He was,
yeah,
you know.
He was that good. I mean, State of Grace, Sid and Nancy, Immortal Beloved, I mean, Murder in the First. He's good. He was good in, for there was a time that, I mean, Romeo is Bleeding. Let me go take that one. I love that film. And
yeah.
he was at this period, he was a powerhouse.
Lena Olin, like a top-notch butt.
She was incredible in that film.
And the missing hand. I mean, that was hot.
With or without the arm, one of the great lines in that film. And, you know, it's... But he's good in it as commissioner. Who would ever thought Gary Oldman would be the last person, I think, to play Commissioner Gordon, and he does it better than anyone else.
A character that's not full of flourishes and color. And,
yeah.
You know, let's cast Gary Oldman.
He brings so much to it. Look, the little party has his Drexel Spivey in True Romance. Great role.
Yeah.
Great fucking role.
I mean, that was at the apex of, you know, of the high school era when all the high schoolers loved him. I mean, you had that same experience, Chris, I'm sure. And,
I was graduating
from college.
I still
do. I still associate him with great acting. When someone says, who is the greatest actor or who is your favorite actor, his name is at the top of the list, even though I do think that in the last 10 years he's just been taking roles that, you know, it's pretty much been Harry Potter movies and Batman movies for the last 10 years. I know he was in the Denzel Washington Hughes Brothers movie. We were all a little underwhelmed.
No, but I think something needs to be made of his performance in that, because it is a good performance. It actually echoes, I wouldn't be surprised if he said to get ready for that part, he watched Ralph Richardson in a 1935 movie, Things to Come, which is probably the greatest post-apocalyptic movie ever made. And he played, Ralph Richardson played a character, the boss. And that's what that character is very reminiscent of. Regardless of what you think of the religious overtones of the Book of Eli, we could spend several shows on that. Gary Oldman's performance in that film is really incredible for what he's echoing in that. I mean,
we haven't even mentioned JFK, where he had
four minutes
of footage to build a character on.
Mm-hmm.
And he's amazing in JFK.
Yeah.
It seems to me that somehow he missed the boat. I know that he's done smaller independent films, but they haven't been the right ones, because it seems to me that an actor of that caliber would want to move to independent films where possibly he could find riskier parts.
Yeah, he's done a lot of stuff that ended up going straight to DVD, unfortunately. Like,
yeah, there's a couple of films that there are a couple that go straight to DVD, some that I've never even seen, but... I don't know if you say he missed a boat. If we're talking about him on this show, this highly, and a lot of people do talk about him, I don't know if missed the boat is the word. I understand what you're saying, though. He has been absent in those powerhouse roles in the last decade. But, you know, he's still got a lot of juice in him. If the Dark Knight or the Harry Potter films are any indication, this is a guy who could do a lot with even the smallest role, or even the Book of Eli, a very mediocre film, but yet he manages to just bring out so much.
Hey, I haven't discussed the question of the week on Facebook.
Oh,
question of the show on Facebook. Hang on, let me get to it.
You don't even know your own question?
I know the question. I haven't memorized the 17 answers. I'm sorry.
Oh, God.
Chris, you actually answered this, and it was a good answer.
I forget the question and the answer. So
this will be a great eye-opening segment.
You've got lives to deal with every week, though, right? I mean, you're out there helping people out, so you got more important things
yes.
to worry about.
Exactly, when I'm not texting on my phone. Yeah.
Exactly.
Where is this thing? It's about music.
Oh, I see it, yeah.
Yeah, I remember this, okay.
The best use of pop. Sorry, I don't want to step on it. You go ahead.
Give me some examples of excellent use of popular music in movies. We actually did a show on this like a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Yeah, we did this. We covered this.
But not with these fans. So, let me... Oh, man, I'm waiting for my page to load. I'm sorry. This is great radio here.
Yeah. Well, mine, I'll just go ahead and say mine.
Okay.
The best use of pop culture or pop music in recent movies, in my opinion, was David Bowie's Cat People in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, that.
For the final Nazi showdown in the movie theater.
That's the Dreyfus prelude, yeah, without a doubt.
Right.
I agree with you. Like, completely an unexpected use of music, too.
Yeah.
Something
But that's what he's always been good at, is using, not only using pop music, but using unexpected songs in unexpected ways.
Yeah.
That's maybe one of the things that he's absolutely best at.
Here, I'll give you two, one old and one new. But I think Chris's is probably the best example that I could come up with. But Singing in the Rain and A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
And the use of the Hall & Oates song in the 500 Days of Summer. Those are the two that come off the top of my head, besides Cat People. Cat People, though, is astounding, because that's the last song you would expect.
Yeah.
Here in 1944, Paris.
Well, I think some people... There goes my screen. I think some people misunderstood the question, because I got stuff like Easy Rider, American Graffiti, just as a general thing. Fight the Power and Do the Right Thing.
I like that answer, though. I remember that answer. That was a good...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's on par with what the question was.
Yeah.
I don't know very much popular music. However, one of my favorite songs in the movie was Sister Christian and Boogie Nights. I also liked all the music in Almost Famous. Across the Universe, Moulin Rouge. Tiny Dancer and Almost Famous, In Your Eyes and Say Anything. Mm-hmm. The best example is Who Will Stop the Rain, I guess,
that's
in the movie.
That's great. I still think he's absolutely right. I remember that, reading that, and it's just a great use of that song, and still probably my favorite Nick Nolte movie and one of my favorite books, Robert Stone's Dog Soldiers. So.
The Big Chill, American Graffiti, The Boat That Rocked, The End by The Doors and Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, those are all good. I mean...
When I'm 64 in The World According to Garp, Phil Spector, Christmas Music in Goodfellas, Scorsese's use of the Stones in general, Layla in Goodfellas. Oh my God, there's more.
Dude,
right back
where, you, man.
Right back where we started from in Slapshot. Also really like the use of the Linda Ronstadt version of Little Feat's Willin' in The Abyss. All the Moon songs in American Werewolf in London, The Graduate, Moulin Rouge, again, Kenneth, another Moulin Rouge, God, all over the place, Moulin Rouge, the Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, in some movie, Good Morning Night, then Chris's answer, Magnolia's
got a lot of great stuff in it.
The Amy Mann stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Devo, The Police, Commodores, U2 in Last American Virgin. Dean comes in with 15 great pop music source soundtracks, including American Graffiti, Goodfellas, Mean Streets, Over the Edge, Paper Moon, Pennies from Heaven, Dazed and Confused, The Last Picture Show, Pink Flamingos, Pulp Fiction, Natural Born Killers, Harold and Maude, Paranoid Park, Rushmore, and Dogfight. Okay, and then he has another list here. Stuck in the Middle with You and Reservoir Dogs, another Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody says Forrest Gump. Wonderful, what a wonderful world, and Good Morning Vietnam. Lou Reed's Perfect Day during the overdose and train spotting.
That's a great. I love that.
That comes from Greta Big Boobs, by the way.
Greta, you're awesome.
I remember
is more so than you know.
I remember taking my dad to see Field of Dreams in the scene where Kevin Costner picks up James Earl Jones in Boston and they hit the highway. China Groove kicked in and the whole audience cheered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man, I kind of missed that Kevin Costner.
I was going to say that's the last time an audience cheered in a Kevin Costner movie.
Yeah, right? I mean,
yeah, what, you know, he'll, I don't know. We'll see.
No, he won't.
You don't think it's over for Kevin? You think it's over for Kevin?
I don't think it's over. I mean, I liked Open Range. I think he'll probably make some movies like that again. I think he'll probably make some movies
I liked
that
Open
are good.
Range, too.
Yeah, but I don't think he's going to be making any more Field of Dreams.
No,
I think that
era is over.
Bull Durham, and I don't just mean baseball. I think the days of him being a matinee idol, of him being a guy who can really sell a movie and capture the country's imagination, I think those days are gone.
I think audiences are no longer endeared by him.
No, I like The Upside of Anger, obviously. That was the last time I really, really liked a film.
And I think that has to do with... That has to do with him doing one too many parts where he's just brooding and distant and unpleasant. I mean, he gave the same performance in Bodyguard that he did in Waterworld. That's what I've always said.
Yeah. He used to endear audiences to him, and now he just makes them sleepy.
There's a lot of truth there.
All right. Let me get to my switchboard screen, and we'll close off with a score from Babies. It's storming outside now, dude.
It's going to do that here, too.
Yeah,
so.
Can go over to my parents for dinner. Not in the rain. All right, here's the score to Babies. I don't know when this movie comes out, but if you have a woman, take her to go see it, and you're sure to get lucky that night.
You said that on Wednesday night, too.
Yes. That should be on the poster, man. I mean, sell it.
Dude, that's the way. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. All right, guys, thank you. Thank you, buddy, for calling in, Chris.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right, cool. Are we back Wednesday night or next Sunday?
We got interviews that we have to get through.
Okay.
So Wednesday night we'll be back.
All right, cool, sweet.
All right, guys, talk to you later.
All right, good night. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Good night.